Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care. Welcome back to Survivor's Guide to True Crime. I'm Kim.
And I'm Kara.
We have been not able to talk in real time for a long time.
I know. That's why you got Kim's so lonely message as the Easter egg last week. Also, speaking of things being lonely and sad, my dog has absolutely no chill and all the anxiety. He's standing on the couch, sadly singing the song of his people because the kids are swimming outside and he wants to be swimming with them. So
don't we all? Don't we all?
Yeah, I know. But yeah, I'm back in the land of normal time zones that I am used to. You know, I actually was mostly able to avoid jet lag. I kind of have like a foolproof plan for jet lag. You ready? Be really, really stubborn and stay up as long as possible. And then go to sleep at the normal time for the time zone you're in. I didn't get jet lag. Like,
yeah, I can't do that.
Yeah, I mean, I basically did. And then, of course, my husband's like, well, you weren't there long enough. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, because he's like, oh, I'm just trying to annoy you now. And yeah, I had a great trip, got a tattoo, saw all the things there were to see, like did everything that I could have possibly wanted to do in Rome. I was there 2 days and I was like, walked 20,000 steps, to which my husband said, that's only like 10 miles. And I was like,
only
who are you? I'm like, what are you talking about? My legs hurt so freaking bad. Like my hamstrings hurt and my calves hurt from walking. And I was like, I have never walked so much that my hamstrings hurt. I don't know. I was just wearing like normal shoes.
Well, I loved that I would wake up in the morning and have a slew of texts or messages or whatever. Like, it's already halfway through your day. So I just got to catch up every time. But basically, if I wasn't talking to you in the morning, I was like, all right, well, I'll just go on about my life as if Kara's absent.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's 6 hours time. I guess 8 hours for you. Time difference. But yeah, it was great. But now I'm home and, you know, we had recordings and calls like my first full day that I was home. I got home at midnight. I was traveling for 24 hours. By the time I got home, it had been 24 hours of traveling and I got home at like 1 a.m. and so went to sleep around then. I mean, today is the second day. I feel fine.
You were surprisingly alert and with it.
I was
expecting you to start slurring if like halfway through and just not knowing where you are. Nope. That's great.
I felt pretty decent. I mean, that's just proof positive that all of the gluten that I ate there did not affect me the way gluten here affects me, which is like all of the brain fog. I can have you know, one cookie here and I'm like, but mm-hmm. No, I subsided off of gluten and dairy solely and felt great.
Well, we're going to do more of a catch up that we can post probably on our Patreon. I'm not kidding. I literally wrote down notes of things that I knew I wanted to talk to you about that I couldn't text out. Yeah. While you were gone. And I knew that we'd have this catch-up time. But so you were in Italy mindset leading up to your trip. And I am now in anniversary trip mindset. So By the time this episode comes out, Mike and I will actually be out at Pebble Beach celebrating our anniversary, paying money to hurt my own feelings, trying to golf. I have no business golfing these courses at all. Very excited, though. So it'll be fun.
And you will be texting me about how sore you are.
Oh, absolutely. I went to the range. Literally just went to the range and just hit a bucket of balls. And my abs, all of my body parts hurt so bad. Like, how am I going to make it?
If I hit a bucket of balls, my abs would probably hurt too.
So we're just going to enjoy the views and not keep score. I think that's probably my best case scenario.
All right. So who is our guest today, Kimberly? It's your friend.
I am so, so thrilled. My friend Anna is joining us on the podcast today. And we're going to keep this beginning part short because we could have kept talking to her for so much longer. And we got into some topics and tackled some things that I briefly knew sort of where we might have the conversation flow. But it was like we were all having these spontaneous revelations in the middle of this conversation, which just again reinforces the point that this is so important to be able to talk to other survivors in a place where you feel safe and you can work through these things in real time. But I loved having her on. I hope you all do too. She is changing the world. No joke. And the things that she is able to speak about and articulate is something that most people cannot. I was really excited to have you two meet finally after all this time. And now you're going to be friends. I'm going to make you be friends.
And my friends have to be your friends because mm-hmm. we're all friends.
So Anna Nassett is best known as an international speaker on the subjects of stalking. As a victim survivor of stalking for the last decade, Anna has firsthand experience of how to identify and respond to stalking. She has trained thousands of professionals, students, and military members on the importance of recognizing stalking, getting help, and advocating for oneself and others.
Anna is one of the very few people who can speak openly about her experience after the man who stalked her received the maximum sentence for stalking, 10 years in prison, in 2019. This is one of the longest known sentences for stalking in U.S. history.
Here's our conversation with Anna.
Hi, Anna.
Hi, Kimberly. Hi, Kara.
Hello.
We're really excited to have you here.
I'm delighted to be here.
I feel like I say I'm excited every time, but I like legitimately am excited. So I want to introduce Anna in the way that I got to meet her, which was through In Violence Against Women International. And Anna had just joined the board. Last year was your first year, right?
Right. Yeah. Or my first year in person.
We bonded over our shared love of the organization and also the fact that apparently both of us are obsessed with champagne vending machines. So mm-hmm. that was a really good way to start things off in San Francisco.
I didn't know that was a thing.
Oh, it is.
Oh. And you get a little token. You go up to the bar and you pay and you get a little token. And it's like every childhood amazingness in an alcohol dispenser. And it was really pretty. And the arm goes up and gets the little, tiny little champagne bottle and it dispenses and then drops it off.
I was going to try and make us one out of cardboard this year because there was none in the lobby. And I was like, can I figure out how to fashion a cardboard champagne vending machine? Maybe next year.
I mean, I would be super impressed if you were able to do that. I feel like that's some mad skills.
I mean, I think we all have other skill sets than what we're doing here right now. So it's important to put those skills to good use, like making cardboard champagne vending machines.
Okay, but that also like just gives me a total Ted Lasso moment when like Nate is making the little boxes, yep. You know, like the little cardboard boxes.
And cards.
I'm like, that's what that makes me think of, yeah. Okay, so speaking of Ted Lasso, that is what I've recently been binging because I feel like no one told me exactly why it was so good. All I heard was like, it's so good, but I didn't have the why. And so I finally started watching it. I was like, oh my God. So I have binged it. So that's our icebreaker question. What is the last thing that you binged, whether that is like a book that you couldn't put down, a podcast, or a TV show? What's your last binge?
The last binge is what I stayed up till 1 o'clock in the morning watching because I flew in back from a work trip yesterday and I always need to unwind. I watched the last episodes of the last like part of the series of Firefly Lane and it was so good.
Oh, so you just like wanted to make yourself cry.
I did. Yes, exactly. Like you go out and do this work, like as a speaker, as a survivor speaker, and you're holding everything in and you get home and I'm like, I just wanted my stacks of quilts, my tiny dog, Dolly Parton, and to curl up with a glass of wine and have a good cry. And so I watched the end of Firefly Lane and had all the feels. Oh, all the feelings.
Yeah, I did the same. Ooh, it's rough. I was not expecting to feel as many feels as I did. And woof, it was something.
I'm really like, I mean, I so strongly believe in like the powerhood of sisterhood and friendship and female friendships and how beautiful and complex and all of the things that they are. And that show, I think, just encompassed it in such a beautiful way that I'm still misty-eyed over it.
So I don't want to give any of it away, but there was a part with like one or two episodes left where I was feeling like, oh, thank God I get my happy ever after. That's not to say it just wasn't my expected.
Well, I don't know if you all do this, but this is something that a lot of people who've experienced a lot of trauma do is I will actually, if I'm watching something I haven't seen before, because I watch the same things over a lot, because I know mm-hmm. how it's going to end, that makes me feel comfortable, which is really common for people with trauma, anxiety, PTSD. So I actually had to look up what was going to happen at the end of the last episode just so I could be prepared for it. So it was still surprising, but it was just like, okay, I'm prepared.
Every once in a while, I will, because my toxic trait is that I constantly have to have IMDb on my phone the entire time when I'm watching literally anything, and I need to know what everybody else has been in, where the filming locations are, and you name it. And every once in a while, I'll be like, oh, they're only in 6 episodes and there's 10. Do they get killed off or something awful? I have to stop doing this. And yet I know that I will not.
No, I won't. I accept it. It drives others nuts. So I just do it on my own.
That's funny. I do not do any of those things, but I also don't watch as much TV as like Kim does. So
yeah.
Or me. Yeah. I'm a big TV watcher.
Yep. Yep. That's my thing. All right. So Anna, I got to say a little bit about how we got to meet, but I would love if you could tell everyone about your story to your comfort level. What brings you here? What has you on Survivor's Guide to True Crime today?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first off, thank you for having me on here. And I'm going to do a pretty abridged version of my story because it's real long. So long that I just wrote a book about it, and that's over 300 pages long. So, you know, we can't really sum that up into quite a podcast. So I'm just going to give you a quick version and then allow that to open us into whatever questions, conversations we have. So basically, my story is that I'm a survivor of gender-based violence starting from the age of 3 years old. And most people know me with my story of being stalked, but I think it's really important that we contextually put in all the different things that we experience just trying to walk this world and walk this life. So unfortunately for me, that started at the age of 3 with a babysitter who sexually assaulted me, would continue on with the bullying and harassment into high school, at which point a teacher got involved in that and I actually had to leave my high school, 2 sexual assaults in my young adult years. And really at the time in life when I thought like, I'm going to shine, like I'm going to be standing on my own 2 feet. I just gotten out of a short and crappy marriage and was living out in Washington State and was like, look at me go now. Like everyone back off. This is my time to shine. So I owned an art gallery at the time and I'd owned that for several years. And it was a little successful art gallery in the town of Port Townsend, Washington, which you've never been there. It's the most stunning little adorable town on the Olympic Peninsula. Just so beautiful. And yeah, like I said, I was crushing it. I was living my dream, just running this gallery, running fundraisers, doing gallery walks, like helping artists launch their career. It was really just like such a passionate time. And unfortunately, in 2011, a man who I don't know, we'll use the name Jeffrey for the case of this story here. Unfortunately, this man, Jeffrey, had been watching me. And in the end of 2011, he first approached me stating that he wanted to show artwork at my gallery. And I quickly decided I didn't want to show his artwork, but he would begin to send me series messages and call my business. And in the messages, like the thing that really first kind of made me go, all right, well, we got a problem here, was that he would say things like, it was nice to see you today. And I'd be like, I didn't see this man anywhere. Like, is this person watching me? What's happening? What's going on? And as things would continue, I would just kind of, you know, start to really check in with my gut. And it was really interesting as I look back on this. When I first started to share with like the guy I was dating at the time or a couple of friends, they would all say, oh, you're overreacting. You're overreacting. This isn't a big deal. This guy just has a crush on you. You have all this trauma in your past. So that's why you overreact. Now, as I said, I just finished writing this book. And one of my friends who works in the prevention side of our fields, she read my book and she wrote me this really interesting thing. And she's like, you know, Anna, I think your trauma is what saved your life because you had that sense. And you had that wherewithal to go, there's something really wrong here. And I was very fortunate in my community that I did. It was a small community, very safe place. I, you know, was known in my community with my business. So when I started to kind of reach out to people that might know if this guy Jeffrey was up to something more nefarious, I had the right contacts,
yeah,
which is not something that a lot of people have, right? And so I quickly went to law enforcement. Immediately, they started by believing me all the way back in 2011 with a crime like stalking, which we all know does not get taken seriously very often, and began to build a case. He would end up serving a year in jail for misdemeanor harassment against me from 2012 into 2013. And then when he was released, I thought, okay, great. Like, hopefully I've shown him. I do want to say that unfortunately, he does have a mental health condition. He does have a rare form of schizophrenia that has manifested into his wanting to stalk people. He initially would stalk people for short spurts of time, but there's a couple of us women that he's stalked now for many, many years. So when he was released from jail, a lot of stalkers, and we could put this into things with domestic violence as well, they know how to walk a really fine line. Like, I have protection orders, I have all these things in place. So he would not reach out to directly to me, but he would send letters to people I know, to law enforcement, very descriptive, very graphic, very vile letters about things that should be done to me, that he felt like we were married, just all over the place. And so I tried the best I could to carry on, but with something like stalking, the last place you want to be is where that person knows you are. So I was closing my business early all the time, things of that nature, starting to lose a lot of credibility in my community too, because people would be like, oh, I stopped by your shop the other day to buy something, but you weren't there. You're so lazy. I had really gone quiet with what was happening because I kept getting that response of, it's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. You're overreacting. Just go to work. When in reality, it was. You know, this is a big safety issue, not just for me to keep myself alive, but also community as well, because there was really kind of this unknown question within law enforcement of, it wasn't a matter of when he's going to kill or if he would, but when. By the end of 2013, I had to close my business, which was real devastating to say the least. But I stuck around my community for a while longer, for a couple of years more. I went to work as the marketing director at a lumber company, obviously, right?
You are wearing flannel. Let's point that out.
I am wearing flannel today, yes. So I'm harkening back to my lumber duty days. And that was really calculated, right? Because it was a bunch of old lumberjacks that worked there, a bunch of veterans, things like that. So I felt like it was a place I could be safely. But of course, you know, when I accepted that job, I certainly didn't say to my boss, hey, thanks so much. Just by the way, there's this guy that thinks we're married and wants to murder me, because no one's going to hire you then. And it's the same with things like housing, right? Like if I was getting a new apartment, after I would sign that lease is when I would say, if this guy Jeffrey ever contacts you, please don't tell him I live here. Don't rent to him, this or that, because no one's going to rent to you before. Or just all of the very basic needs that victims and survivors really struggle with. Like he used to be at the grocery store all the time. So I would grocery store shop out of town or odd hours. So very basic needs that we have. I stopped exercising, taking my walks. Like if I went anywhere, somebody was walking with me, even if it was just like a half block. So my life really just kept shrinking down. And in 2015, unfortunately, my father was diagnosed with cancer and it was very aggressive and we knew it was going to be a very quick passing. So I went back to Ohio to be with my family. That's where I'm originally from. And that's what I did. Cooked for my family. I ran my own little like nightly cooking show for my parents, cooking with Anna, and would like plate them food and just, you know, try and be there as much of an encouragement and support as I could. But also I was like the family errand runner. So suddenly I'd grocery shop and I wasn't scared that I was going to be killed. Or in the evenings when my dad was asleep and my mom and I had finished up our conversations, I'd walk my parents' yard by myself in the dark, something I hadn't done in years.
And things that you take for granted too.
Yeah. And I didn't realize how removed they were from my life until this really traumatic and tragic time of watching my father pass. So I knew when I, after he passed, I went back to Washington that I really needed to face the reality that I should probably move. And that's so often what happens to stalking victims, people in domestic violence situations, is it's, we are the ones that are not only considered dangerous by others, but also the ones that have to accrue those costs, make those huge changes, all of those different things. And I really, the final kind of nail in the coffin for me was that Jeffrey actually had me serve papers to go back to court because I have a lifetime protection order against him. And he was trying to get it removed because so often they'll use the criminal justice system to recommit the crime. Mm-hmm. You can't come speak to me, but if you get me served papers, I have to show up. You're going to get to stand right next to me. So that was really the final kind of piece for me. And I would end up moving here to Vermont in 2016. Oh, this week, actually. It's my Vermont-iversary.
Oh, congrats.
Thanks. So I moved out here and just kind of thought I would quietly start over. I went to work for this little nonprofit, but I was really missing my besties out Westies. And so I flew back for a quick visit. They all chipped in and got me a plane ticket and I went out there. And while I was there, Jeffrey saw me someplace, I'm guessing, we don't really know. And he would begin again to directly message me very, very vile things, very graphic, not only about me, but threatening towards killing law enforcement. There was a lot of things that were at play during this. And we started to build this felony case. The original prosecutor didn't want to take it on because I live far enough away that he said I was safe. So I was really at the ends of my rope, very, very depressed, suicidal, in fact, because it just was like, this is never going to end. Either he's going to come out here and kill me, or I'm going to have to live with this for the rest of my life. luckily I had good support. I had therapists. I had good friends who were checking in on me daily from Washington to here. And I kept filing everything that came in, kept filing any of the messages that came in. And eventually it's all very legally nuanced. So I'm not going to get into that because it gets a little wild. But basically there was another prosecutor who did take on the case, a man named James Kennedy, who was my absolute hero. He was just so clear and direct with me. He's like, I don't know if I can prove stalking because no prosecutors want to touch this with a 1,000-foot pole because you're trying to prove something where there's not a physical wound, but I'm going to try my damnedest. And he just built this case, and it took us from 2017 to nearly 2019 is when we would go to trial. And I had so many people just like supporting me and helping me. I had an advocate here from the Vermont Attorney General's office prepping me because everything was happening, you know, thousands of miles away. So I think I met James twice in person before the actual trial. Like my victim witness coordinator, I met her once. There's people I didn't even meet until the day of the trial or afterwards. And we went to trial. And Jeffrey decided that he really wanted to defend himself, which is
common.
Common and legal. Mm-hmm. So that was super fun. Let's just be real clear. And I just, you know, had as much strength as I could muster, but was so just like physically ill. I know that's something that Kim, you and I have talked about before. And in fact, we're doing a presentation on it because it's so important to be able to look at those things. And we can talk more about that after I finish this. But I testified for about a day and a half. And every time I opened up my mouth, he would object. It just felt like this is just never going to end. So everything I practiced and prepared for, all of those things that they'd done for me, this felt like they flew out the window during that. But we did get through it. And when Jeffrey cross-examined me was really, I think, you know, the pinnacle of everything. It was like, oh shit, how's this going to go down? He started out pretty clearly. And through his line of questioning, I don't remember the exact questions. Plus, I don't ever want to listen to it again. But basically through his initial line of questioning, he was asking me really specific questions about like where I was living and where I was working in 2008, before I owned my art gallery, before, you know, he made his first contact with me in 2011. And so as he's asking me all these questions, I can see like my friends that are in the room and the prosecutor and my victim witness coordinator, I can see everyone's eyes just start to like bulge out of their head because we all realize that he hadn't been watching me since 2011. He'd been watching me since 2008. So years before I even knew. Luckily, he was found guilty of felony cyber stalking and aggravated felony stalking. And then we began that process of going to sentencing. And I sat and wrote my victim impact statement and was able to read that into the court from here in Vermont. Luckily, I was not in person because I could hear it all and it was an absolute shit show, to say the least. I've never been so glad not to be in a room. And even during all that, like the prosecutors, everyone was like, you know, the maximum's 10 years, but we're not going to get that. No one's ever gotten that. Like, we're going to be lucky to get 5, but he may even walk on time served the day of sentencing. We just don't know. But as I said, it was the right people all along. And so the judge that we had that day was able to really see stalking for the psychological and sexual crime that it is. And he gave him that full sentence of 10 years.
Woo-hoo. Yeah.
So I'm in my decade of freedom, a couple years in. Yeah, now just like work to go out and educate and encourage others. And I really feel like I cannot be the exception. This needs to be the standard. And when we look at, you know, stalking as a whole, the whole concept of like, I don't like to use the word celebrity stalking, but like the stranger stalking is such a small amount of what we normally see, right? We're normally seeing someone you know, you used to date, you were married to, any of those things, a neighbor, a friend. And when people are going in and reporting those things to law enforcement and to advocates, they're getting turned away time after time after time. My emails, my inbox fills with that, right? Because people don't understand the complexity of these crimes. And they also do not understand the lethality, especially when it's somebody you know, that like 76% of women who are murdered by a current or former partner, there was stalking in the year prior. Like that's horrific.
Yep.
And so for me, it's like, if I can take my story and share that to educate people so that everyone else is doing that too, when someone says I'm being stalked, I really firmly believe we can save lives. So that's my quick version of a very long story. And thank you for asking.
Yes. So this is my first time hearing your story, because I'm sure you're the same as Kim and I are with this. I don't like to consume people's stories always before I talk to them in person.
Yep.
One thing that I want to point out that I absolutely love that you highlighted is this overlap and these similarities between domestic violence and stalking. Because as you were describing so many of the things that stalkers do, it sounds just like domestic violence mentality.
Yep.
And it makes sense that there would be a lot of overlap there. So I'm so thankful that you highlighted that. And I'm sure you have speaking points and things that you want to say about that, since this is your job. Because for those of you who don't know, this is a lot of what Anna does, is speak about stalking and domestic violence. So if you would like to speak to that, I would love to hear your input on it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think back in the day when this all started for me, like, one, to even be able to find the word stalking and use that was really challenging. To be able to say something like, I'm a victim of crime, was really challenging. But it was pointed out to me several years ago when I moved here to Vermont. I started taking a course through the Vermont Victims of Crime Academy. In fact, I'm having dinner with my mentor and the person who started me doing my speaking in a couple hours, which is always a treat. But I sat down with this woman and was like, how do I move my work into this field? And so when I started my business, Stand Up Resources, I thought it was going to be doing graphic and web design for victim service agencies. But she asked me why I wanted to do this work. And I kind of whispered out my story for the first time. And she said to me, she's like, what's really interesting? She's like, your story is horrific, but I've never heard of somebody having such a positive experience across the board going through all these different systems. And so that's when I really stepped back and started educating myself. This is before I ever started speaking anything, to go, okay, wait a second. Like, the treatment I've gotten is what everyone should get, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this weird level of privilege in this really, really messed up situation. So how do we start to interlace that? And that really was looking at the intersection of domestic violence, the intersection of sexual assaults within stalking, and bringing those more to the forefront. And when I do my full case study, I do a lot more of that, especially when I'm talking about those basic needs of housing, of food, of transportation, being able to walk, go to a bus stop, anything like that, that can be so limited by somebody who is experiencing domestic violence, because it comes back to that point of, we're the ones that are considered dangerous.
Yeah.
And so really educating people to understand that, one, we need our basic needs met. And I can give an example, like when I went to trial, I had to take so much time away from just working that I couldn't even pay my rent. And it's not like we get paid to go to trial, right?
No.
And we have a community fund here in my community. So I had to apply for assistance and was very fortunate to have that, right? But so if me, who doesn't have children, doesn't know this person, has, you know, lives in this beautiful place with privilege or whatever, all those things, I can't afford my rent. What's going on for everyone else?
Yeah.
And that's what we really have to be looking at. And, you know, it really does come down to educating law enforcement and advocates and just continuing to bring in that intersection.
Yeah. I love that you brought up the point about how you, as the survivor, bear the brunt of the financial impact, because that is what happens when we become victims. I think of, it was like a little image going around Instagram, and it said the average survivor of sexual assault, it cost them, I think it was like $150,000 over their lifetime. And most people that commented on it, they were like, that's on the low side. Mm-hmm. So I think of that, like you said, with trial and like having to take time off of work and all of those things. I think that is something that is not often talked about, but anyone who has been a victim of a personal crime, they hear that and they're like, yes, thank you. I feel that. Like, you feel it inside of your bones.
Yep. Took me years to pay off my failed business. And I mean, I come from a good family who has had to help me out as well. You know, I had to relocate across the country. And that relocation is something that's very common as well for stalking victims, especially, and then also domestic violence victims, if they can. Because when you have those kids intertwined or anything like that, it's so much more complex.
Well, in the court system, not just on the criminal side, mm-hmm. but the civil will keep those, it holds you hostage that are being victimized,
right? And it actually tends to flip and make it look like, oh, well, this person is just trying to get their kids back, right? And it villainizes the protective parent or those children.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I know that this is going to be kind of a softball question because this is a conversation that you and I have had multiple times, but it bears repeating, especially for everyone listening. When we talk about stalking, we talk about it on a continuum. And I know you and I have talked about, you know, this is viewed as a quote, big air quotes here, everyone, lesser crime.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that continuum.
Yeah, I mean, it is viewed as a lesser crime, and that's really frustrating. I mean, I get it because sometimes I'll even say that. I'm like, stalking can lead to homicide, domestic violence, sexual assault, can lead to. So if we take stalking seriously, we can prevent these things from happening. Now, that being stated, I at this point have now been, and I do want to be clear, like I intertwine the terms survivor and victim pretty regularly.
Mm-hmm.
I say that I'm a survivor of the other things that have happened in my life. But when it comes to stalking, just because he's in prison doesn't mean this is over. So I will often refer to myself as a victim when it comes to stalking. So I just want to clear that up real quick. But I look at it as going, okay, so even unknowingly, I've been a victim of stalking for 15 years now, which is, someone just pointed that out to me. I was like, oh God, 15 years. I hadn't contextually put that in my mind. I was like, ooh, that's horrific. But he's going to get out, right? And that's going to continue. And if I look at all of the physical things that have happened to me internally, all of these different things, how do we compare or qualify what is worse, lesser, any of those things? And I think we need to kind of get away from that is the biggest thing. And to go like what each one of us is sitting with and experiencing is valid. But when we have that narrative that we've had for years, that I've heard for years, that we see projected on TV, that we see when we go and make reports, it does make it look like stalking is a lesser crime. So I'd be curious to hear your two thoughts on that as well.
We are so thankful for all of your support. We're also supported by Cured.
They are a supplement company that is changing the industry standard for how supplements are made. They are products that I use every day that have genuinely changed my life.
Kara, of course, is the one who introduced me to them, and I was a little hesitant at first, but I can say after using their products for the last couple of months, I'm hooked.
My favorites that I think everyone should try and will love are the Serenity, Zen, and Rise. Serenity gummies have ashwagandha, L-theanine, and CBD. They're going to help you to just relax, take the edge off at the end of a long day or whenever you need it. Zen is going to help you fall asleep, stay asleep, and sleep soundly. Hallelujah. And Rise is going to give you sustained energy and focus without caffeine or without a crash.
I was really hesitant to try anything I view as a sleep aid, but I can say after incorporating Zen into my nighttime routine, I am getting such better sleep.
Yes. And for all of our listeners, you can use code KARA10, go to curednutrition.com or go to the link in our show notes to take you straight to the website. We hope that you love it as much as we do.
Yeah, I think that it is tricky to quantify anything as a lesser crime. I think anytime we get into this, and this is not from like the legal standpoint, this is more so from a personal standpoint. I get messages all the time that's like, oh, I'm also a victim, but it was nowhere near as bad as what you experienced. I'm like,
all the time.
Always.
And we take that out. It's like, maybe what you experienced was quote unquote a lesser crime or less intense, but maybe the way I dealt with it was less traumatic. And maybe the way for you, you dealt with it was more traumatic for you. So, I mean,
I love that. Thank you.
It, just like anything, I can't answer anything in like a black or white. I'm like, it's not black or white. I'm like, it's so much shades of gray. Like anything that happens to you, I struggle to say that it's less impactful or less intense because it's like, no, if it was impactful for you, it doesn't matter if, you know, you got in a car accident and I was brutally assaulted by a stranger. Like the car accident could be more traumatic for you than the sexual assault was for me. So I don't know.
Absolutely.
And then if I look at it from like the law enforcement perspective, I can see how that happens. Having worked in law enforcement, it's difficult.
If you talk about it in terms of law enforcement or the criminal justice system, you do have a scaling method, right? It's like F1, mm-hmm. F2, M3, M2, M1. So you have to put a quote unquote number or level mm-hmm. with whatever crime that is. And I think so often people will default to whatever level that crime falls at, even without a complete understanding of what goes into that charging decision or what elements need to be met. If they think, well, it's a misdemeanor because maybe it's harder to prove, or maybe there's just different elements to that crime. It's way harder to prove intent in stalking than it might be for somebody who carried out the commission of a sex assault or an actual physical act, right?
Yeah, prosecutors are way more likely, like if it's stalking in conjunction with domestic violence, they're way more likely to go with a domestic violence charge than they are stalking. If there's a burglary attached to it, they're going to go with burglary versus stalking because you then have something physical.
Yeah.
And I really, you know, I look back on my prosecutor and I just like give him so much kudos for being like, no, I'm going for it. Like I'm going all out. I'm doing this. And to touch on what you said, Kara, because I get a lot of that too. People will write me and say, oh, mine wasn't as bad as yours. Or I'm speaking, they come up like, oh, mine wasn't as bad as yours. And I have this thing I usually say in my talk and it's just like, I don't care if you were stalked for a day, a week, a month, a year, or 15 years. That emotion that you're feeling is the same. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we might all feel it differently, but those things last with you. And I can think of a woman in my old community in Washington. This is when I worked at the lumber company. We were doing like a home show together. And I was like, oh, let's promote it on social media, whatever. And she's like, oh, I don't have social media. And at the time, she was probably in her late 50s. And I said, oh, really? Why not? And she said, well, when I was in high school, one of my brother's friend stalked me for about 6 months. And I've just never been able to get over that or feel like I can comfortably have a social media presence. So we're talking 40 years later, still is sitting with that. And that to me really hits to the core of it. Like what we're feeling is just as valid for each one of us.
Well, and I teed up the softball question because this is based on a conversation that you and I had. It was during Stalking Awareness Month. I was putting together some informational videos. I had pulled stats that you'd had up and such, and I was putting together videos for Eva. And I remember doing one and I was like, whoa, wait a second. Am I a victim of stalking? And I had this like, what, it's been 16 years. And I had this moment where I'm thinking, but I didn't know I was being stalked. And clearly it's not as bad as Anna's or, you know, all these other ones. And I don't want to detract from that. But I was having a kind of out of body experience. And so I just remember I'd text him like, do you have time to FaceTime? Mm-hmm. And we hopped on and it was so validating. And still, I don't know that that's the right term for it because I didn't realize, I guess, I didn't realize that that period of time from 2008 to 2011, he had stalked you. I thought it started in 11 and I've seen your talk before. I don't know how I missed that. Do you consider yourself in hindsight a victim during that time, even though you didn't know about it?
Really good question. That's a hard one. Like if we look at the definition of stalking, like the Department of Justice definition of stalking, to paraphrase it, it is a repeated course of conduct that causes a reasonable person fear for their safety, the safety of others around them, or severe emotional distress. So I didn't know Jeffrey existed then. So those first 3 years, that's hard to say. Now, if we look back on it, we look at something like your story, Kim, we look at so many other stories that we're seeing in the news, we see that there is that stalking element. I'm going to speak a little bit because this hasn't all gone out to trial or anything like that, but we can look at the young kids who were murdered in Idaho, right? Those four kids. There was definitely, it looks like, a level of stalking at one point. And I believe one of the victims actually began to kind of say something about it, maybe voiced a little bit about it. Like I said, this hasn't gone to trial, so not everything's been released, but
this is all alleged.
This is all alleged, but we can look at that and go, okay, maybe she was starting to notice something, but what if she hadn't? So I think it really speaks to the thing of we need to be aware for those people around us who might be a victim of these things and they don't know it, right? Like I can now look back and piece together strange things that happened at my gallery, little oddities, this and that, and go, okay, it all connects now. But at the time it didn't. So it's really hard to say. I mean, I think Kimberly, you could say like there's a stalking component to my story and to my case. And that's important to address that because it also brings us to that place of being like, let's be aware of our surroundings, right? Like, I mean, I know I'm probably like aggressively aware, but just to have that is really important. So I don't know that what I would say as far as that 2008 to 2011 time period. It's a good question.
It brings up that same nuance with why it's so hard to charge or to get a conviction on, because the element that we are talking about that makes you feel like, and not to put words in your mouth, that you're not a victim and then suddenly you are being victimized is completely on you, right? That's the element that they're looking at.
Yeah.
It's that fear base that you have to be fearful or know that something is going on.
You also have to prove all the evidence. With stalking, like,
yeah,
I have to be my own detective, my own investigator. I have to document everything.
Yeah.
And most of the time you're taking what are things that are not against the law, like an unwanted gift, emails, messages. In theory, these are not against the law, right?
Yep. So not only are you looking at you and those things that you're receiving, are you feeling fear? Did that person know that they would make you feel fear? Are you going to be able to convince a jury of your peers of that as well?
During this entire conversation, I have been thinking back to me working in law enforcement and working these cases. And I'm sure it's different from state to state, but in South Carolina, it's essentially 3 unwanted contacts after notice. And I feel like in a lot of ways, stalking is like this silent crime because it's like, okay, that's weird. Okay, don't like that. Okay, it's still continuing. And then you're like, okay, now it's a problem. And if you did not have those things documented, I would get a call, I would get a case, and I'd be like, I'm sorry, ma'am, there's nothing I can do. I can't prosecute this.
Yep.
So now I'm hyper aware, knowing that that's the law. Like, if someone is contacting you, you get that shit on paper. Like, you get it.
You document everything.
Like, hey, here's a text message that I sent them, or here is, you know, you can send a certified letter, or you can send like a no trespass notice, but basically a no contact order. You know, there's these things that you can do, but it almost feels like it's silent until it's not. And at the point that you feel unsafe, if you have not been documenting it, you don't have any course of action.
Which, who normal lives their life that way? Normal people don't document every single interaction.
And that's all I've been thinking about is how I've worked all these cases. And I'm like, my God, it's like at the point that you feel unsafe, it has already been going on. You've already had those contacts. And so I think that's one reason why it's so important to have this information out there. And like you said, have that situational awareness, pay attention to your surroundings, know the red flags, which is one of the big benefits of social media, right? Like, you can't open up social media without seeing something about a red flag. I mean, I can't anyway. Maybe that's just the content that I...
Yeah, no. I think our algorithms are all probably pretty synced up. Let's be honest.
Right. But I also think in general, like, young girls are getting more information about like what actually constitutes stalking, what is a red flag, what constitutes sexual harassment or abuse, so that they can become more aware. But I just think how isolating that must be, that you are, yeah, I mean, you're alone. Like you said, all of the burden is on you. And I just think it's very unique crime.
Yeah. And it's very unique in that way that I have to take that ownership upon myself. And then it's also very challenging for law enforcement or advocates. You know, when I first walked into the police station, I said to the officer on duty, I've gotten these messages and the gift of a painting. I'm scared.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, luckily, in my small town, they knew who Jeffrey was. But if they hadn't known who Jeffrey was, how do I sound walking in there?
Right.
That I got the gift of a painting and a couple of messages. I do not sound right of mind, right? And I'm in a scared place. I'm shaking. I'm in trauma. So it's so challenging for that role, where oftentimes law enforcement advocates will be like, these people are having a mental health break here, when really we're just so freaked out.
I think I sent this to both of you yesterday. I saw just a little screen grab on Instagram, maybe, and it was about domestic violence and the term dog whistling.
Yeah.
Have you heard this?
You just sent it to me. Yeah.
Oh, for our listeners, it validated this term and this feeling that I did not have words for before. Dog whistling, in essence, is something that your abuser or even a stalker could do that out of context, no one would look at and be like, oh, that's creepy or that's weird or that's abusive. But in the context of typically a domestic violence relationship, that abuser knows the impact that it's going to have. You understand as the victim the context. And so they can do these things in public right under the nose of, you know, friends, family, law enforcement, court officials, and it makes no difference. It makes you seem crazy when actually it's that dog whistle that only you can hear because you know what's going to follow. No one knows your abuser better than you.
Absolutely.
And I could not think of something better. The other thing that I had thought of as you were talking about this, Kara, Anna, share what you call your keynote, or at least what you did last year, the name of it.
It's called Stalking Slow Motion Homicide. That one?
Yeah. Yes. So perfectly put.
That term was brought up by, there's a stalking expert, Dr. Patrick Brady, and he's the one that coined that. And I just think it's so poignant. And I reached out to him, I was like, can I use this? He's like, yeah, absolutely. But I think it's such a great term, not only in how stalking can end, but also in the effect, because it's so debilitating for so long that you feel like this person is slowly murdering you.
Mm-hmm. So coming from a law enforcement perspective and having worked these cases and knowing how problematic it is to prove a personal physical crime, I understand the difficulty, but where would the improvements be for law enforcement when they are facing someone making an accusation of stalking, someone making a report of stalking? Where would the improvements be in your eyes?
I think the biggest things are education of law enforcement, which is something I do and love doing, because I think that we can't fix what we don't know. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big part of it, is just that basic education. Like, people know that stalking is against the law. Law enforcement does, at least, but, you know, not everyone else in our country does. So it's that basic education. And along with that, it's also really teaching trauma-informed investigation, to understanding that when I'm coming in and saying, I have a painting and a couple messages from, let's say he was an ex of mine, and I'm in that place where I'm shaking and seem frantic and all of that, taking the time to put in trauma-informed practices to really understand why I am scared, why that person coming in and reporting is scared, and then giving that victim the tools that they can use to empower themselves. Like, for me, the biggest thing is that I need to know everything, right? So back in 2011, once I started to realize and be able to wrap my head around the term stalking, like, I'm Googling everything about stalking there is, and there was very little at the time. But I did find stuff, and that was helpful because then I could contextually understand what was happening to me. Now we have a lot more resources. So SPARC is our federally funded Stalking Prevention Awareness and Resource Center. Stalkingawareness.org is where you find them. They do not provide direct services, but they provide a plethora of resources for law enforcement, advocates, prosecutors, judges, universities, family members, victims. They have documentation logs on there, threat assessments, all sorts of different tools. And so that's a place that I always really point people to, because I don't need to reinvent the wheel. They've already done it, right? So I think that's a great place for law enforcement. Like, so one of the things I say to victims who contact me is I tell them to print out the documentation log and the law enforcement resources and take that into the police station with them. Because as much as I hate to say it, I think when we bring in those resources, we're more likely to be taken seriously and believed. And it's not something we should have to do. This is not a burden that should be on me or any of the other 13 million victims who are being stalked each year. But until we get better laws, until we have more and more education, understanding, we got to do that.
That would be absolutely, like, monumental if a person came in and they said, I have this log. Like, everyone can look at that and say, here is an incident. Here's an incident. Here's an incident. I think that that is something that definitely would be great. I mean, anytime you're faced with making a difficult decision, if you have something, you can rate it on a scale or you have the documentation. Like, I can imagine they have something to the effect of, is it stalking? Is this a problem? Right? I'm sure they have some sort of assessment resources. I just think that that's great. Great. I love that resource. I'm so glad that's available.
What just caught my attention too, talk about the threat assessment, because I think in my context, I am used to doing suicide assessments. I had to do a lot of those when I worked at the prosecutor's office based on what kind of clientele I was working with that day. Talk about the threat assessment though, because that is a tool that I think people that are not actively experiencing it as the primary victim can still look at.
So it's more like it's a stalking assessment. They have a whole little kind of thing on there that you can look at and start to put in all of the different things that are happening to either you or someone you love and be able to really look at that. It's a little bit different than the log to be able to then say, yes, this is stalking. I think that's something that's really important, and sometimes to show our loved ones too, because, you know, we're getting that language of, this isn't a big deal. Get back to work. Just do your life. Just ignore it and it'll go away. So that's something I also say to people is, like, give this to your family members. Give this to the people, like your spouse. Give this to your employer so that they can understand that stalking is a real thing. So just being able to look at that assessment and go through it. I'm not sure I'm speaking to that exactly how I should, but
I think on here it's called SHARP. Does that sound right? Stalking and Harassment Assessment and Risk Profile.
Yep.
That's exactly what I was hoping there would be. And I didn't even think about it in the context of being able to show it to friends and family too, because that's so important. I think of when my elderly dog, we were trying to make this decision every day. Like, do we make this decision to let his life pass, or do we, you know, keep him here? Is it selfish? And the vet gave us this assessment scale. And I think of how much of a relief that was. I mean, we had to do it every day, right? But that was with our family pet. And I can imagine with something like this, where you're like, it makes me uncomfortable. Am I being like too scaredy? Like, am I being a scaredy cat, or is this something that I actually need to worry about? That's just, I love a good tool. I love it.
Well, if you can take a BuzzFeed quiz, you can do right. some kind of assessment like this, right? I think of this too, because it would be extremely helpful when you have not yet developed the vocabulary or the world experience that comes with just getting older and being in more relationships. I think of teenage relationships, especially. Mm-hmm. In teen relationships, it is not always that one person or the other is bad. It's not a good and bad. It's that they may not have fundamentally developed those processing skills, those emotional maturity skills that go into a relationship. And some of the things that they do can manifest as stalking behaviors. When you don't have that kind of language, you don't have the ability to say, oh, well, I know that this isn't because I've been in a relationship before and he wasn't a narcissist. He was an asshole, right? Like there's so many.
That is such a fine line though. Like, let's just say
that is a whole other tangent that I could go down. Like, everyone wants to say that their ex is a narcissist when in fact they might just be an a-hole, and it could be that they had narcissistic tendencies. There is a very big difference.
Or they might just be like super not self-aware.
Right. Or just a douche. Like, it's there are so many different things, but when we automatically jump to one thing,
fun quiz, narcissism or douchebag, which one?
BuzzFeed, if you're listening, just give us a byline. It's fine. We'll help you write it.
We need someone to create for us a dark humor crime victimization survey that can help you.
Well, that's like our whole new niche.
But if you don't have that language, you know, it can be helpful to go through some kind of quiz that's very basic, elementary, but ooh, okay. So sometimes they do these things, and breaking it out into smaller things instead of just slapping a label on it.
And I think with that on the side, like, you know, we're talking really specifically to victims and survivors right now, but I think it's also important for people to go, oh, sometimes I do these things. I have to know where my person is all the time. I have to know where they're at. If I don't know, I get upset. I keep showing up at the bar where I know this girl's going to be at, even though she's told me she doesn't want to be with me. Starting to understand that if you're doing those behaviors, that is stalking, and looking inward at yourself to going, okay, maybe I should change that. Maybe I should learn some things. Maybe I should learn some healthier boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe in the fundamental ability for everyone to change, but I believe in the capacity for a lot of people to change.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes, you know, if we don't know, we can't change. I find that a lot. Like, if I'm at a military base or at a college, I know that there are young people in there that are doing those things, but they didn't know that that was wrong.
Right.
That, you know, they probably fundamentally probably did, but it's just to highlight that a little bit. And I can always see the eyes that go,
I just had the moment that you said you had when you and Anna were talking. We were like, oh, I was a big, I'm like, shit.
Shit, man.
I absolutely, when you said showing up at the bar, I'm like, oh, shit. I definitely had a situation where I was in a relationship where he did not lay his hands on me, but it was very much a domestic violence relationship. And when I tried to end it, 100% he stalked me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he would show up outside my bedroom window and like yell at me until I came out. And I was working at the sheriff's department at the time. And I remember being at a baseball game and like one of my higher up supervisors being there. And he was like, I just want to let you know I'm here. Here's my phone number. Let me know if he shows up. And at the time I was like, this is an overreaction, because I was 20 years old. And I was like, I feel like they're all overreacting. Like, why are you guys acting so weird? And I'm like, shit, because he was stalking me. He would like, you know, show up at the bar where he knew I was at with other people and call me 28 times. And when I didn't answer, he would show up there and come inside. I'm like,
I had a boyfriend in high school, called my cell phone and home phone alternating 40 times.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because I broke up with him. And, you know, he's just heartbroken, right? We find all these ways to excuse that behavior, or it's not that bad. Because if we can minimize it in our own minds, then maybe we can minimize the trauma that we have to feel and process too.
Right. Let me be clear. Jeffrey's not the only person that's had inappropriate and stalked me. Like, I have an ex as well who's done. I have a couple exes, actually. But something that I heard you two both say, and I'm going to tie into as well, because the situation I'm thinking of specifically with an ex happened in the last several years. So knows my whole story, knows all of this, still does this, right? But contextually in my head, and maybe you two feel the same way because of the experiences you've had that were so traumatic when you're young, you're like, well, it's not that bad because this was so much worse.
Yeah. Oh my God, we are our own worst enemies with that.
Absolutely. I'm like, and then as you were talking, I'm thinking back to like Kim asking you, did you consider yourself a stalking victim before you knew? And I'm like, well, where's the nuance there? Was I scared? And I'm like, well, I wasn't scared. But other people were like, he's acting like a fucking psychopath.
Right. But you've already experienced such fear and terror in your life.
Right. That it was scary to me.
Yeah.
See, and with you both know this. I'll just share it with the thousands of people. I didn't realize that I was being actively sexually assaulted because it wasn't as bad as a stranger who broke in through my window.
Right.
And still to this day, the like just work that it took to even get to that word was bizarre to me. So here I am out advocating and doing all of these things and working for survivors, including myself, and didn't even realize it was happening to me because I'm downplaying it so much, because I don't want to have to deal with that compounding trauma.
Which I think speaks to so many people who are listening today, because how many people do we hear from and they go, oh shit, I didn't even realize that was inappropriate.
Yeah.
And now I'm trying to validate in my head the fact that I was a victim. I mean, I literally just had a conversation with someone a couple days ago who she didn't realize until years later. She was like, you know, she was at a party and someone gave her something and she woke up and he was giving her oral sex and she was reading a book and she was like, why do I feel so viscerally wrong reading this one scene of this book where a girl is sexually assaulted? Because she had never realized that what she experienced was sexual assault and that it was in no way her fault, because she was like, I was at a party. And it's like, that is just so, so common to so many people. And
oh, absolutely. Hey, everyone,
welcome to us being jet lagged and dealing with all kinds of like active trauma. And here we are having these revelations where we're like, listener poll, everyone, right. Who among you listening has had an oh shit, TM, right. Patent ending moment since you started listening.
Yeah.
Because I sure shit have.
I mean, I'm just in an Uber the other day and she happened to be a female Uber driver. She asked me what I do for work and I told her, and she then launches into her life story, and that's fine.
As one does.
As one does, as we know happens. And, you know, she's talking to me about her ex-husband and all of this stuff. And I'm like, oh my God, like stalking, domestic violence, everything, all over it. And she just didn't have the language to that. And I mean, I wasn't going to put that language on her. So I just kind of allowed her to keep talking. And then, yeah, like she had been communicating with somebody she met through Instagram that she was just madly in love with. And he was, I'm assuming he's pretending to be a doctor overseas. And she sent him $8,000. And she's like, should I keep talking to him? I'm like, oh, honey. Ugh. Like there was so many layers to this story that were just heartbreaking. I'm like, but it is that thing of like, we don't know. So often we have to like, it comes up with that oh shit moment of like, oh God, yeah, that's me. And our ability to still compartmentalize and still say to ourselves, go back to what we said at the beginning, oh, well, it's not that bad. I've experienced this much worse. Or this person over here has experienced so much worse, whatever it might be, instead of really looking at our own experiences and doing the work on it.
As we are sitting here telling people, literally every day, I say to someone, please don't compare your trauma to mine. Here I am comparing my trauma to my trauma. Do as we say.
The human experience.
Well, it just goes to show we're always learning, right? Like we're learning along with everyone else. Like just because we're out there doing this work and speaking or however we do it, writing, podcasting, you know, all the different things that we do, we're still learning and we're still trying to heal our own shit.
There's a phenomenal Brené Brown quote that I'm going to butcher here, I'm sure, but it's something about when she does research and talks and puts out all of this information for other people to learn from. She may be a cartographer, but that does not mean that she is always the experienced explorer or traveler. And I'm sure I got that wrong, but like, just because we can make a map for you of the places that we have been or the things that we know does not mean that we're going to be able to read the map the same way. And it doesn't mean that we're going to know instinctively where to go and what to do in all aspects. And so if we are having these conversations ongoing and challenging ourselves to look at things from a different perspective, to take on more information, to change our minds when we see that it's fit, that's a sign of growth and healing and helping others, starting with yourself.
Absolutely.
One thing I want to come back to, because this is really important, and I know that you had alluded to it at the beginning. Talk about the physical manifestations that you've experienced from this crime or a lifetime of gender-based violence and how those have impacted you.
Yeah, super fun subject. Love talking about it.
I feel like it's also a topic that a lot of people are very surprised by. Like the number of trauma survivors who are like, oh, this trauma could have to do with all the health issues. It's like, yeah.
You know, I share these things because I think it's so important that we normalize these conversations. You know, for years, we just sit so quietly in our own head and our own bodies, and we're not normalizing this. And so just like you said, Kara, when we put this out here, people start to go, oh shit, like, yeah, that makes sense. So for me, some of the things that I've had, I mean, there's eating disorders, depression, anxiety, all of those things that I deal with on a pretty, not eating disorder anymore, but definitely deal with anxiety, depression, PTSD, on a pretty high level at all times. But the physical things for me has been like having times where I've actually urinated myself, where I was in such a place of fear, having severe tummy troubles a lot of the time. Like I should own stock in Imodium AD at this point. Love that one. Any potential suitors out there, it's the way to this girl's heart. Just bring me boxes of Imodium.
Which, I mean, honestly, one of the things that I get people that are so surprised by is like food sensitivities and digestive upset when it comes to trauma. And it's like, bro, I don't know any trauma survivors who don't have digestive issues. Like, I don't know any personally.
Yeah, I'll drop the big bomb in a moment of one of the things I've had happen. But I found that especially after the trial, I could not stop burping or farting uncontrollably for like 2 weeks. Everywhere I went, I was just like, I get physically ill a lot. But really, like, I mean, we're joking around, but that's kind of helpful sometimes, right? Let's joke about our shit.
Obviously, because everyone does it.
But like,
I have no information or helpful knowledge, but may I interest you in some sarcasm?
Right, exactly. So like, now I'm about to say something that's like so hard to hear.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay. We're good. So for me, like the thing that was really the most profound was that when Jeffrey was really at his worst in 2017, I was not yet 37 and I stopped having my period and it never came back. So I went through like complete early menopause, like hot flashes, the whole nine yard. I don't have children. And I knew within this, I never would have children. Not some of his other victims do. And like, we all have our own choices, right? On how we proceed. But for me, just knowing that like, this is something this crime is going to follow me till either he dies or I die. That's it. It's that simple. But that concept of having my body cease to menstruate is pretty, pretty wild. So that's something, and I've heard of other people have that for short periods of time, part of my period pun. But it is pretty massive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really massive.
So I approach things from, I think I've mentioned this somewhere along the way. I did holistic health coaching within an integrative practice. So I hear these things and I kind of default back to that mentality of having worked in that field. And it's like, well, obviously, if you think of the basics of fight or flight, all of your body's energy goes to fighting. So you literally get increased blood flow to your hands, to your feet, and it diverts that energy away from digestion. It diverts it away from being reproductively sound, because it would not be safe if you just ate a hamburger, but you have a lion chasing after you. Obviously, all that energy needs to go towards running from the lion, not digesting the hamburger or having sex and making babies, right? So being in a state of active, continuous trauma, obviously your body's going to stop digesting correctly. You're going to get food sensitivities. Your reproductive system is going to falter. Like all of those critical things for being healthy and well, the energy is diverted away from it. And so I hear those things. And I'm like, duh. But again, people don't talk about it, right? Like people aren't like, oh, you had trauma? Well, do you also have like irregular hormones or difficulty getting pregnant or maintaining a pregnancy or digesting gluten or, right? Like people don't talk about these things.
Yep. But we are.
Yeah, we are.
We're going to talk about these things.
So one of the things that Anna and I and Allison, who is another friend of the show here, are going to be presenting on at the next conference, hopefully, fingers crossed, is about these physical manifestations in victims and the things that we experience that might not automatically in our minds tie together, but we know that over a certain amount of time that these are brought on by stress, extreme stress, PTSD, trauma, whatever they may be. And my latest one, after having been now in active state of trauma, fight or flight for the last 3 years, as I am following along in your footsteps and am perimenopausal. So I'm kind of bummed. I finally had it confirmed with the doctor. And still, I'm like, all right, that's just price I'm paying and what I have to do. But it's one of those that's like, it's impacting my ability to be human. Mm-hmm. Someone else's actions, prolonged actions, are slowly killing us and keeping us from doing the things that our biological bodies know to do because of the immense amount of stress. How can you say that that is not serious bodily injury?
That was what I was going to say. I was like, how do we get this into law so that things can be escalated to serious bodily injury? Because for the people who don't know that terminology, serious bodily injury is how a crime is escalated. That takes it to the next level legally.
Yes. You want to talk about classifying things. SBI is what notches it up. If you were going to compare things in a criminal justice system or with sentencing,
right,
or whatever it might be, that's how you notch it up, is you say that something caused death, dismemberment, serious bodily injury. And funny you should say that, Kara, because there is an attorney in Mike's office who just recently had a case where they charged serious bodily injury for PTSD. And I will have to get the case correct, but it was landmark.
I do remember at the very last question that my prosecutor asked me before the cross-examine. I mean, it's somewhere in my wall, but it was basically like, is there any other things that have happened to you that you feel like are relevant? Is there anything else that's happened that you feel like are relevant? And I got into this place where I was so scared, because I knew what was going to happen next was Jeffrey was going to cross-examine me, that I forgot to say about my period, right?
Yeah.
I just like got so frozen. And so we get done and I was just like, oh my God, James, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I completely screwed up the whole trial. I forgot to say this. Like my brain just went blank. Like I just got so scared. And he was just like, girl, you're fine. You're absolutely okay. Like, but that was a lot of what he was trying to bring out. And I did write about it in my victim impact statement and think that it definitely played a part in that sentence that we got, was to be able to speak to those physical things that we hold.
And we still are in a place where a jury wants to say, well, tell us that it directly, like with his hands, did he make you stop menstruating? And that's not the tie anymore.
Right.
And I would hope that we are moving beyond that.
Yeah. But that's really, I mean, that's the part that people want, right? And I am going to use this. I'm going to segue into this thing about my book right now, because I think it's,
please,
it kind of highlights this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm writing this book. I started writing the book proposal 2020. It's an arduous process. If you ever want to publish, it's a horrific, horrific process that is so, so intense.
Yeah.
So I went after and finally got a book agent, and he, you know, is taking me to all the big publishers in New York and small publishing houses and everything like that. And I kept getting rejection after rejection. And the two reasons were, they kept coming back and saying, she's a really good writer, which I am, damn it. toot toot to me. So they kept coming back and saying she's a really good writer, but she does not have enough social media followers and he never sexually assaulted her. So it wasn't that bad. So here I am, the person with the longest sentence in our country's history, and publisher after publisher denied picking up my book because he didn't physically touch me. And if that doesn't say a lot, I don't know what does.
It says everything. We can hop right on our soapbox about all of this. Yeah, I'm also in the process of going through the proposal, let's pitch it. And it's just one thing. We don't want to buy a memoir in the true crime genre because she's already told her story. It's already out there. Well, we don't want to buy a self-help style book from her because she doesn't have any letters after her name. And it is constant, even for those of us who are out here doing the work, that we are constantly invalidated in our trauma. So if you also are invalidated, no, you're not alone. And we see you and your trauma is valid. It is so frustrating. And we here at the podcast, we get told, you know, we're quote unquote not sexy enough for ad revenue or for deals or it is infuriating. And I hate that that happened. I don't have enough followers. My crime wasn't high profile enough. There's a million different things that they can come up with to say, you and your story and what you have experienced, sorry, they're there, and pat your head when I'm like, but I know person after person that has approached me about this, they can't be wrong in saying that something that I've said has helped, right? And it's those little breadcrumbs along the way that are saying, no, I know that this is something that is worthy and passionate. And like your heart, I know it's the same for all three of us, and probably, I don't want to speak for them, but everyone who has been on here, we are pulled, if not shoved, in this direction over and over by something in the back of our minds that is telling us we are in the right spot for the right reasons, and we're doing the things that we're supposed to be doing, even when it's hard, even when there's people outside of us that are telling us not good enough, not sexy enough, not worthy enough, not enough followers, all of these things. No, not enough, not enough, enough. We are enough. These stories are enough, and enough of them together is going to make a difference.
Absolutely. I mean, I firmly believe that each one of our stories has already saved lives and will continue to save lives. Like 100%.
Have no doubt.
That is the entire mission. I don't need to ever know who that happened to. That doesn't matter to me. It's not about those like, oh, okay, well, this happened over here. But it's about that ripple. That's what I always say when I'm speaking. I'm like, each one of you is now a pebble because you know all these people I don't know. And you're going to take this with you and you're going to remember this when someone discloses to you or whatever it might be. And that is what it is that we don't necessarily, like none of us necessarily want to be doing this work, right?
Right.
I don't know. I can think of other ways my life could have gone. I don't know about y'all, but we are pulled and called to do this work. And we've been asked to do it for a reason. And we keep doing it. And so screw them if they say no. I wrote my book anyway. And I found a hybrid publisher and I'm going with that. And I'm really happy with it because I get all the ownership of it. I get a lot more freedom within how I wanted to write it to interlace all these other stories and facts and just things that a traditional publisher probably wouldn't have done. But I'm so pleased with the fact that like, this is mine.
Yes, mm-hmm. It is. You go, girl.
I'm taking the risk to do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So tell us about your book. You're still in the process of writing it. When will it be out? Do you know any other details yet?
Yeah, it'll be out late summer, probably like beginning of August will be. So we're in pre-orders now. So you can go to ballastbooks.com or you can go to my Instagram, Anna, A-N-N-A, period, Nasset, N-A-S-S-E-T, to buy a pre-order.
Pick me.
You, yes.
Oh, hey. Hi, I'm Kim, longtime listener, first time caller. And please tell us about your cover art for your book.
Well, you know, one, you should never have an artist write a book because trust you me, I was so obnoxious about the cover. I was like, hate it. Oh, I know I told you this is exactly what I want, but I hate it.
Sounds like us in our podcast art.
Oh, Lord. oh my gosh, I put these people through the ringer. And then in the end, I basically like, I came up with a concept and like they tweaked it, but there's kind of an overarching story throughout the whole thing. If you can see behind me, I have a lot of white sunglasses. And so there's kind of an over, like another storyline going through the whole book. And you kind of at the very beginning see that like I'm always wearing white sunglasses, but at the very end of the book, you find out why I wear white sunglasses and have since I was 3 years old. So the cover art is a pair of white sunglasses and then like masking tape over the mouth, and it's called Now I Speak.
I love it.
And I'm very pleased with it. Yes. So I'm excited.
I'm so, so excited. Well, and I also want to point out, just to bring this full circle, when I first met Anna, our mutual friend Lenora had said, you have to meet her. She's amazing. And then we were together at EVA. Hit it off immediately. I know I text Kara. I was like, oh, she's our people. And it was one of those where Kara and I say this all the time. We're good at this? Question mark? And it was one of those instances where I've been hanging out with you now for a few days and then I pop into your session and take your epic picture because that's what I do. But it was like, oh, holy shit. She is real, real good at this. So much so that where did you just recently speak?
I mean, the OVC, which is the Office of Victims of Crime, they have National Crime Victims Rights Week at the end of April. And I got to go be one of three keynote speakers in front of the freaking Capitol in DC.
Woohoo! On the Mall, standing where people have stood for so many years that create change and ripple effects throughout centuries of our history. And you absolutely deserved every ounce of space that you were able to take up there and every amplification of your voice in that moment. And I'm just real, real proud of you.
It was one of those moments in life that like I will never forget. It was like one of the top days of my entire life. Like at the end of it, like I had a friend with me as a support person. And like, she was like, Anna, I gotta go to sleep. And I just sat in my room and drank a little glass of champagne. And I was like, I can't go to sleep because if I go to sleep, then it's over. But it was so profound. I got to meet people who, you know, I met this guy named Rich Wiggs, who his wife was murdered years ago by her stalker. And he was also shot. They had a little tiny baby and like maybe 2 or 3 year old daughters at the time. And at the time, stalking was only against the law in 14 states. So he turned that into his passion and was able to get Bill Clinton to sign it into law back in the 90s. So, you know, to meet these people who I'm alive because of him, you know, and just how that work keeps continuing and continuing and to stand in that place. Yes, where so many historic people have spoken. And then to meet people who have profoundly impacted my life, the lives of millions of others, it was just amazing. It was nuts. Definitely a bucket list thing.
Oh, gosh, yeah. And you will never know how many people you stood before and are changing their lives, and you'll never realize it. But
that's the thing, is we keep standing on one another's shoulders to keep this work going, And the people that we're helping protect, they're going to help protect more. And we're going to get more laws passed and better legislation and all of these things if we just keep doing the work.
So beyond the book, which is now on pre-order, we're going to put it in our show notes and everything else. Tell listeners where they can find you, how they can interact, even though I know more about your Facebook now.
So I am on the Facebooks. I think it's Stand Up Resources. My Instagram is Anna.Nasset. So ANNA.NASSET. I'm on the TikToks. I'm horrible at the TikToks. One of these days, Kimberly is going to teach me how to do the talkies. It's Anna Nasset, just one word. So yes, I'm on all the Facebooks, the Instas, the talks. And then my website is AnnaNasset.com or StandUpResources.com.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for taking so much time out of your schedule and being with us. And just,
this was the best.
Every time I talk to you, I walk away like feeling just happy. And I can't wait to see you again so we can find another champagne dispenser.
I know. And we'll bring Kara along with us. And I just want to say, like, I know all three of us were a little tired today and we're so, you know, we're coming off of Sexual Assault Awareness Month and trips and work and all of these things. And honestly, like, my energy is like so much higher now.
I know.
From spending time with you all.
Same.
So we're all working alone in our own silos and doing these things. And that power of being able to connect is so special. So thank you.
I agree. Thanks for being part of our crew. And, you know, we just always hope that we are just continually expanding these circles and bringing more and more people in to this work and this community. And because, like you said, we're all out here. Kim and I have had many conversations, and we've had them here on the podcast, about how this work is so lonely and how very often the people in your normal life don't get it when they're like, how's your day? How's your work? How's your this? You're like, well, like normal people don't get it. So, right. So it's so nice to just add one more person to the group.
Imagine being single and trying to date while doing this work. Super fun. Super fun.
Oh my gosh. We need a new segment called Messed Up Tinder Bios. What do you even lead with? That should be, yeah, that should be like our, what would your Tinder bio be? It's like, what is your elevator pitch? But even more like unhinged, really. I mean,
what I normally do is if somebody asks me out, I give them my business card and I'm like, just look through my website. And if you're still interested, let me know. So I'm like, I'm just not fucking around. Like, this is what I do.
It's like when people ask me, and like strangers, and they're like, what do you do for work? I'm like, well, like,
well, do you guys have alter egos? Do you have a secret story? Because I just decided to come up with a lie. So like, yeah. So I now, like, I have a, like, I've been playing around with them, but I've got one now.
Okay. What is yours?
Yeah.
Mine is that I represent a couple of clothing brands and I'm in town selling to some boutiques.
That's a good one. My husband had to have these because the nature of his job. He's like, I don't know how to explain to people what I do when they ask. And I'm like, you got to figure that out. I think he would tell people sometimes he sold insurance. It's like, nobody has a follow-up question. They're like, ew, you know, like something super boring, you know, where there's like no follow-up. I'm an accountant.
At a place where accountants work.
I'm an accountant for accountants.
So maybe that's the new move. Maybe the new move is just to, because I'm like, oh, I'm a keynote speaker and an influencer. Like, oh, what do you speak on? And I'm like, well, I was kidnapped when I was 15. And they're like, what? And trying to explain it to someone who is not a native English speaker. And I was like, oh, I was kidnapped by a serial killer when I was 15. And she was just kind of like stared at me. I was like, you don't know what the term serial killer is. That's not something in Italian. That doesn't translate. Now, if you have someone who takes like a lot of people and kills them, serial killer? I don't know. I was like, are you familiar with the term? And then when she got it, she was like, oh. Very, very lost in translation. I was like, and this is the owner of the winery. So, you know, it's like, oh, on a winery tour. It's super casual.
Yeah.
Went even better then.
Like sometimes, like if I'm traveling, cause I, you know, I travel alone all the time. Like if there's like, you know, if I'm at a hotel bar or whatever eating, like sometimes I will say what I do, like, cause you've got the guys that are like, oh, well, she's here alone. Mm-hmm. Well, one, I get mistaken as a sex worker sometimes.
What?
Cause I have like kind of, I've got this look, you know, and I'm sitting at a hotel by myself at a hotel bar. And so that's always real amusing. And then I say what I do. I'm like, the opposite here. Not a sex worker. work in the gender-based violence field. And they're like, what's gender-based violence? Like, okay, here we go. But that usually shuts them down real fast.
Thank you. That's exactly what I think I said that in, yeah, was that Jazz's episode, I think, that I was saying? People, like, if they sit next to me at the airport bar or next to me in the airplane, and it's like, I can't get away. So what do? Well, I talk to law enforcement and prosecutors about the proper way to handle sexual assault cases and make sure that there are harsher sentences. What's the one thing you would like to see in the world? That would be harsher penalties for parole violators, Stan, and world peace. what I was going to say, though, so a night that we were at Eva in Chicago, Anna and I go over to a little restaurant. We're waiting for Mike to come, which, mind you, we had a meeting, so we were going to be a little later. Mike had to leave and go get his food that's on his Food Channel bucket list. So he went and ate by himself and he was going to come and meet us. And we were sitting outside, really great weather, having a drink.
and Mike's going to be arriving. And so I asked our waitress, I was like, oh, he's going to want a Jameson on the rocks. She didn't deliver it to our table when he arrived.
Mike sits down. Yeah.
Mike sits down.
Mike comes and sits at the next table over because we were at a 2-person table. So Mike's like right across from us.
But we're like, it's not patio. It's very clear. Like we're together and we're just sitting across talking to each other. And she delivers it
so great.
At the end of this patio. And we didn't know that. This guy comes waltzing up to us. And
so she delivers it and says it's for this guy. Yes. She like says, these women sent you a drink.
Oh my God. He walks up. He's like, I wanted to thank you for the drink. And we're like, huh?
Who are you?
Like, what is it? And he's like,
And Mike is like, actually, I think that was ordered for me by my wife. It takes it from the guy.
And he's like, oh, shit, I thought I still had it.
So these guys, they were at the conference as well. They're law enforcement. So they'd been texting everybody from their crew how these two women sent this one guy a drink. So they're texting everybody back wherever they live in California, like, oh, check Sergeant so and so still got it, whatever. So now we've crashed his world. So we do then send him a drink to be like, you still got it. But like, I kept running into them the rest of the week. And the guy who, like, you know, the drink happened with, he was just, I was like, oh God, I'm getting some good laughs out of your story. He's like, just turns bright red. He's like, you're telling people? I'm like, oh yeah.
Oh, totally.
Oh yeah, I'm telling
people. It was so great too, because then Mike and I spoke the next day and we're walking by and he's like, hey, thanks again for the drink. And I'm like, oh my gosh. They were so great. They're such great sports. It was just, it was hilarious. So that's
it was so funny.
I guess that's the way it, for the pickup genre for the youth. I don't know.
Well, or to pick up older men. I mean, I don't know. Like, yeah.
Again, Anna, though, thank you so much for joining us. It's been quite the pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain. If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show. To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com. Thanks for listening.
Well, see you later.